Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you very much for joining us on this, the Cisco Virtual Symposium on Virtual Machine Network in partnership with Tech Field Day and the Packet Pushers. We have a crew of people here to talk about the exciting, interesting, tedious, long-winded, complicated, and fun topic of virtual machine networking. What do we mean by virtual machine networking? We broadly want to describe how our servers connect to the data center network. And once upon a time, it was pretty simple. We put a server in, we plugged a cable in to a switch, and we knew exactly where we were. Today, we have VMware, we have Nexus 1000V, and with recent modern advances in the data center, we have Nexus 2000 using FEX on 5000s. We have Cisco UCS using FEX 2200s with the MK81R Palo adapter, presenting multiple virtual NICs to the operating systems above. How does this all come together? That's what the discussion is about. Because virtual symposiums are where we bring a panel of people about who are also experts to have a discussion about some deeper concepts in networking. It's partly about keeping it nerdy, and it's partly about having a flowing discussion where we throw various ideas around the table. You, the listener, are encouraged to ask questions. There's a chat window where you can ask questions, and the panelists will strive, insofar as we can, to answer your questions as we go along. So first of all, let's run around the virtual card table to see who's joining us on today's event. And I'm going to run down from the top first. So David Davis, please introduce yourself to the audience.
Thanks, Greg. My name is David Davis. I work for TrainSignal and create video training products around VMware vSphere. And I also write for a lot of different, you know, online publications like Virtualization Review. And I'm glad to be here talking about virtualization networking. Thanks for having me.
No problems. Ethan the Banks.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for having me on today. And most of the people that are going to be on the virtual symposium will know me as one of the hosts of the Packet Pushers podcast. And I blog up at packetpushers.net, CCIE, and I'm glad to be here today.
Mr. Pepulniak.
Hi, I'm Ivan Pepulniak, and I'm usually the resident skeptic, and I'll try to fit that role today. And I'm blogging at ipspace.net and ioshints.info.
And I like the beard. Is that a summer edition?
Oh, of course. It's the laziness edition.
I figured that was you turning into... Are you going to grow a big, like, big Unix power beard to be able to control all the SDNs?
Oh, no, not yet. I'm a networker. I'm not a sysadmin.
So you're not going to have a Unix power beard and go all SDN on me and say it's all software. You know?
And sandals. No, not yet.
Well, thanks for joining us. And also joining us today is Lawrence Krieger. Lawrence, please introduce yourself.
Yeah, hi. You can call me Larry. I am a principal engineer at Cisco. I am also one of the co-authors of the VXLAN draft. So I guess my expertise here is in VXLAN.
Ah, very cool.
Thanks for inviting me.
No. Wow. That's a pleasure. It's good to have somebody here who actually knows what they're talking about for a change, because I know, goodness knows, I always just keep making stuff up. I'm not everybody else. It's just me I'm referring to. And I think finally with us today is Marko Milivojević. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hello, and thank you for having me here. My name is Marko. I'm a CCIE instructor at IP Expert, and as usual in these virtual symposium or podcasts, I'm here to ask stupid questions. So I guess that Larry and others will have great fun answering them.
How about Stephen Foskett? Did it go quiet?
Hello, this is Stephen Foskett. I'm S. Foskett on Twitter and blog.foskett.net, and I organize the Tech Field Day events and co-organize this virtual symposium with Greg. And also I do a lot of speaking on virtual machine networking, so I'm pretty psyched about this topic.
I am here. Omar Sultan from the Data Center Solutions team at Cisco. Focus on a lot of emerging technologies and have been working on the Nexus 1000V and related technologies for a few years now.
Cool. Okay, so that's the people around the table. It is kind of a full agenda. There are five cameras working, so we're going to try and mix up some of the guests who you can see. So for those of you who are watching at home, first of all, hi, Mom, how you doing? It's good to see you. And secondly, let's kick off with a bit of a discussion around, I think I want to start with Omar about, can we summarize virtual machine networking easily. I mean, I gave a bit of an intro there where it's kind of complex and it sounds like it's all a bit mixed up. But what's the business case? Let's start off with a bit of a very rapid, because it's not very interesting, discussion around the business case for virtual machine networking.
Sorry, Omar's audio has dropped.
Okay, so I'll pick it up from there and talk a little bit about it. So virtual machine networking is probably being driven by what VMware is doing. And VMware obviously started off with got a successful hypervisor off the ground. And I guess, David Davis, this is really your area of expertise, because you've done a lot of VMware training videos and stuff like that, where VMware really changed the way servers connect to the network and how they're hosted. Instead of one per physical server, we've got 10 or 20 per server.
Yeah, or even, you know, many more with Cisco UCS. You know, you might have hundreds per server. And yeah, that's really mixed up things, you know, in the network and how the servers and virtual machines relate to the network infrastructure. So I believe that's, you know, where these solutions that we're talking about today step in to try to solve some of these problems. But, you know, in doing so, they also create a lot of complexity and, you know, confusion. You know, even for someone who tries to stay up to date with this kind of stuff, you know, I still feel confused. So hopefully we can clear it up today.
So, I mean, that's the real shift, isn't it? That's the thing that really brought virtual networking to the fore, is that, you know, once upon a time, one server, one NIC, and now we're really talking about, you know, multiple servers in a single place and the loss of control. I mean, certainly from a networking point of view, we have a loss of control about what servers are connected where.
Exactly, yeah. And then, you know, to throw things in the mix even more, you know, you've got cloud computing and, like, VMware vCloud Director, and, you know, they're using things like vShield to, you know, connect multiple data centers together to create a hybrid cloud. And, you know, of course, those virtual machines, they want them to be on the same network, even though they're not in the same place or on the same, you know, physical LAN. And, you know, so that's, again, where these solutions come in to try to help.
So I think that's enough talking about the business case, because if you're probably listening to others, you'll probably want to hear more about the technology, because, you know, that's fine. That's more than enough. So I guess I'd like to sort of throw a question over to Larry Krieger about the Nexus 1000V and, you know, how it fits into the VMware stack. Just very briefly, can you describe that out for us?
Sure. So the Nexus 1000V currently shipping supports VXLAN. So and it's currently the only product at Cisco supporting VXLAN. So, clearly, it's easy for us to add features on the Nexus 1000V because it's a software switch, so we only need to write some code, don't need to design any new ASICs. So so VXLAN support is on there, so the significance of that is that only virtual machines are able to connect to VXLAN at this moment in time.
So the way that works then is that we've got V servers or virtual servers inside of a VMware environment. VXLAN creates a tunneled network over the top of the network that's underneath it, and Nexus 1000V is the software that creates that injection point where so that servers can communicate with each other without actually having any physical configuration in the network underneath.
Right. So VXLAN defines something called a VXLAN termination endpoint, or VTEP for short. And what this does is it allows the packets to get encapsulated basically in IP and UDP to be carried over an underlying network that can carry UDP packets. So it can be a routed network, or it could just be a bridge network as well that carries IP packets, as we all know in data centers today. So, yeah, the Nexus 1000V performs that encapsulation-decapsulation function. The virtual machines themselves, they think they're connected to a VLAN or a LAN, basically. They think they have a virtual Ethernet connected to a virtual LAN.
So to VXLAN, I mean, we at the Packet Pushers, you know, we've talked a lot about what VXLAN means, and we've recorded shows with Ken Duda as well as Han Yang from Cisco about VXLAN and what it kind of means. So listeners who want to sort of go back and learn more about VXLAN can perhaps go and find those shows and learn more about that. But so I think the thing, because you're the co-author of the standard, what's the future of VXLAN? What does that look like?
So the future, VXLAN itself is defined in a draft, you know, submitted by Cisco, VMware, a bunch of other, you know, networking companies and hypervisor companies. So that's there. People can implement to it. The thing about VXLAN is it specifies not just an encapsulation, but it also talks about how the forwarding tables are built to actually, you know, send the packets from one hypervisor to another or from one VTEP to another. So that's some of the thing that's missing in some other GRASes. They specify an encapsulation, but they don't tell you how you build your forwarding tables. Hmm. So it's possible and today for you to actually take the spec and build an interoperable implementation with it. And we have some interoperable implementations mm-hmm. we've done in our engineering team with other companies as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so as far as the future goes, in ITF, what we've identified is the way VXLAN works, it's simple. One of the nice thing about it is because of its simplicity, it's easy to build interoperable implementations. Some of the places where it has scalability issues are when it comes to multicast. If you really have a very high density of VXLANs, you may run out of the number of multicast groups that your hardware infrastructure can support. So one of the things we're trying to do in ITF is to standardize a control plane to allow this interoperable implementations to work without requiring the need for multicast.
And one of the things about VXLAN, a lot of people don't realize that I'm being told that Cisco was the initiator of VXLAN. That was where you started off as?
It started off as a discussion between both VMware and Cisco.
Right, so it's a joint thing, but Cisco's definitely part of it. It's not just a VMware thing.
No, it's absolutely a joint thing.
Okay. So today the Nexus 1000V is going to act to support that. So Ivan, do you think, with virtual machine networking in your area, what are the things that are driving you for that?
Do you think virtual machine networking in general or VXLAN and family in particular?
Bit of both, really. I mean, because there's two parts to it. I mean, obviously there's the networking part. So what does virtual networking mean as in terms of connecting servers to the network? But what does it also mean in terms of what the network looks like in the middle? I mean, we could get stuck into DCI.
Okay. Mm-hmm. No, I will not even touch DCI today because, you know, we would need another hour just to cover all the failures that could happen there. So effectively, we have two options today as I see it. Either we re-architect all the applications and make them work correctly like they would work in a cloud environment like Amazon, or we recognize Thank you. Or we recognize that the applications will not be changed in the next 10 years because some of them are probably still written in COBOL, and we try to emulate their existing environment as they see it today. And today what the applications see are VLANs that are tied together with load balancers, firewalls, or maybe routers doing some access list filtering. And in virtual machine networking, we simply have to emulate that environment, whether we like it or not. And we know that we've all been doing this with VLANs, and VLANs have a number of scalability limitations. So as soon as you go above, let's say, a few hundred physical servers and multiply that by 50 or 100, depending on how many virtual machines you have a server, mm-hmm. you get this huge layer 2 domain, and anyone who becomes too chatty can just saturate the whole domain. So obviously, this is not stable. This doesn't scale. This is not useful in large environments. And this is why I like the MAC over IP approach that Cisco started with VXLAN. Because, okay, let's admit we need layer 2 connectivity between some servers because some people are doing some crazy things they should never be doing, but they are doing it, so it has to be MAC over something. And that something could only be IP because this is the only thing that's available in every single data center. So whether we like it or not, something like VXLAN is the only way to go.
I have an alternate question here, and because we talked about VXLAN, and Cisco recently announced another product, the Cloud Services Router, the CSR-1000V. That one sits, as far as I understand it, in the similar place in the virtual machine stack where Nexus sits. With the addition of a full-blown router, is there really a need for VXLAN, or could we push the networking inside the virtual machine the way we have been pushing it towards the edges of our networks before? And, for example, instead of relying on the new technologies like VXLAN, which are granted very good and sound interesting, but they have not really been proven over a period of long time, could we maybe implement the similar solutions using proven technologies like MPLS and VPLS?
Well, Marco, first, let me address the cloud service router part of it. It's a VM. So it's Cisco IOS XE running in a VM. A VM has a number of interfaces. They look physical to the VM. They're actually virtual NICs inside a hypervisor. And then you connect those virtual NICs to whatever port groups the hypervisor can present. Some of these port groups would be VLANs, where you could use guest tagging or switch tagging. So this would appear as trunk port or access ports to the iOS XE. Or that port group could be VXLAN based. So the cloud services router would sit on top of VXLAN. It wouldn't be aware that it's actually working over a VXLAN emulated NIC. What you are asking, and I totally agree with you that would be a cool idea, would be to port the iOS or Nexus OS code into Nexus OS VSM. Sorry, the Nexus 1000V VSM. That control plane module that Nexus 1000V is already using could start offering things like you mentioned VPLS, MPLS, VPN, who knows what else. And yes, I'm hoping that will eventually happen, but we're not there yet, and cloud services router is not addressing that particular niche.
I mean, there's a question here from the audience here saying, I'm concerned about, I work at a big enterprise, this is Michael Payne, VXLAN concerns us as there is no control point and relies on flooding across potentially big areas. Now, VMware has indicated a move towards a controller model. Now, to be fair, VXLAN was always a controller model because you always had to have a tunneling start point and a tunneling end point, and that always has to be controlled, right? Today, it uses multicast to broadcast the MAC tables across the entire network. I'm waving my hands around because you can actually see them. See, that's what the virtual whiteboard looks like. See? Huh. So there's going to have to be a controller. I would have think, Larry, is it going to be a controller built for VXLAN, or is it really just meant to be like an autonomous, self-creating, self-expanding, self-doing thing all on its own?
So when I hear the word controller, I think of a big central brain that knows what's going on, and it's controlling everything and orchestrating everything to make things work. If that's what is meant, then it's possible. At this point in time, right, in ITF, we're talking about control planes, and there's lots of ways of doing a control plane. You can have one central controller. You can have it, you know, semi-centralized, where you have kind of a distributed central system, or you can have it fully distributed as VXLAN is. So which way we go, I'm thinking it's probably something in between, kind of not a fully central controller, but a distributed control system. But we're way too early in IETF to say what the solutions are going to be.
Yeah, I guess what I was...
Okay, there's one other thing. Sorry, Greg. There's one other thing that has to be mentioned now that we mentioned controllers. Nexus 1000D itself has a distributed architecture. So we actually have one or two VSMs which are doing exactly the same thing as OpenFlow controllers would be doing in an architecture that would rely on OpenFlow. And then you have up to 64 VMs that sit in individual vSphere hosts and provide a forwarding function. And it's not exactly the same thing as what OpenFlow would be doing because these VMs do some dynamic self-learning. It's not like you would download the flow data from the controller into the VMs. So they're a bit more autonomous than, let's say, OpenView Switch is, but it is the same architecture. We have a redundant controller, we have two VSMs, and they're controlling up to 64 switches in 64 hypervisor hosts. So when people start talking about SDN and how this is new and how these distributed controller-based applications are all new and have never been seen yet, this is not true. We had architectures like this for years.
That's true. And as you say, in the case of the Nexus 1000V, the VM is semi-autonomous. So in the case of VXLAN, when learning occurs, it doesn't bounce to the VSM, and the VSM proves it and sends it back down again. It's being done independently in each VM. But each VSM is the management point where you can go and control what IP addresses a VM uses. You can look at the statistics, and you can troubleshoot from there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the key point, one of the key points to bear in mind is there are a lot of different ways to skin the cat, right, when it comes to VM mobility and how you handle that, and specifically what you're looking for, whether it's just DCI type of stuff or you just want to support vMotion or live migration, warm migration, cold migration. A lot of times the conversation seems to collapse around, these software-based approaches. And, I think as you're trying to figure out what to do for your organization, part of it is to take a step back and be open to looking at different ways to accomplish what your application require, what your business use case is.
Yeah, I agree. I think that when I said more about controller of VXLAN, I meant more about the configuration of it. So to me today, the configuration of the vSwitch or the distributed vSwitch VDS in VMware is managed by the vCenter control platform that VMware deploys, for example, right? And I would see that VXLAN would be strapped into the same configuration management system, or do we need to? Is that what the requirement is?
Well, actually, that's exactly how it works. Because one of the primary use cases for VXLAN is deployment of tenant networks in the cloud director. And there you just configure the basics on Nexus 1000V, and then you allow the vCloud Director through vCenter to configure the port groups on Nexus 1000V and VAMs as appropriate.
Right. What vCloud Director does in that case is the tenant is interacting with the vCloud Director to do something to trigger the need for a new virtual network to be created. At that time, it communicates with the VSM and the Nexus 1000V, which goes and creates a new VXLAN as needed and a port group to back it with.
Now, the other thing to think about, of course, is, and this is a good question here from Fernando Montenegro, is he says, from security angle, should we consider hypervisor-based security inspection, in other words, virtual firewalls, virtual IPS systems, or as discrete VMs where you actually route through them, which is what some vendors are doing, or do you actually run them as part of the hypervisor functionality such as what Cisco does with VPath? Ivan, I think you've got some ideas on that one.
Well, actually, the answer is both approaches are viable. The hypervisor, the approach where you have this functionality in hypervisor kernel is obviously way faster. The problem is, what will your PCI auditor say? Will he accept the approach where you do the filtering in the hypervisor kernel, or will he require an external device that is managed independently and where he can see the choke point with inside and outside interface? Because he will not see the inside and outside interface if you do hypervisor-based filtering.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's part of the problem is, I think PCI compliance is less... You can't actually say that virtual firewalls are inherently insecure and therefore won't pass PCI compliance, because PCI now says it's not about what you do it with, it's about how you do it. So what they want to see at a PCI compliance level is, have you got a firewall and is it being logged and is it separating the data so that it's so you've got an audit trail in case of some forensic requirement, and is it protecting the data that's behind that, the data that's behind it? And in conceptually, having the firewall right on top of the server creates more security because it actually means that the firewall's right where the data is. But the other side of a virtual firewall, which is enabled in a virtual networking environment, is that you can have a lot of firewalls. So if you've got one firewall per server, you've got a configuration problem at that point because you have so many firewalls. So instead of having one firewall with 1,000 rules, you've got 100 firewalls with 10 rules in each. And you've got to be able to track those through the network. So the security becomes a configuration challenge, and that's the PCI compliance problem, is how do you validate that your network configuration is, if your security configuration is valid. And that's the problem with that, to me anyway.
I guess a question for the panel. So how do you, you know, what approaches are you using in your own environment here or the customers you work with? Because, you know, as I talk to customers, it still continues to be one of the stumbling blocks, right? You know, security of services in general.
I can speak to my experiences that the institutions that I'm working with have generally got security processes in place that do not allow for the use of virtual firewalls or virtual security appliances because they're inherently regarded as insecure. And that's based on previous experiences with the product. Now, it's probably possible to change that, but in an economy, I'm finding that in an economy which is down and a lack of resourcing, and because of ITIL, you know, everything's got to be a project and it has to be funded. I can't fund a project to change security process, so we just get more of the same. That's my personal experience. I mean, Ivan, I don't know.
But Greg, quick question there. If you have, strictly now, not as a criticism of the approach, just as I said, I'll be asking stupid questions.
Yeah.
If you have a firewall that sits outside the virtual environment, we can only make two assumptions. One is that the firewall is not aware of the virtual environment, therefore it cannot be effective as a firewall. It's basically just a checkbox somewhere that says, yeah, we have a firewall. And the other thing is, if the firewall is aware of the virtual environment, wouldn't that make it much less efficient than if it was sitting inside the hypervisor and be close to the data, as you said?
Well, Marco, there are a few, you've opened a few cans of worms. The first can of worms is where should a firewall sit? Because remember, we are trying to emulate traditional application stacks. So you have an outside VLAN, you have an inside VLAN, you put a firewall between the two. And we can emulate that within a virtual environment. So you have a firewall VM, which has two NICs. You connect the inside NIC.
Let me just interrupt you, but that's the thing that we just discussed within the traditional IT environment that relies on ITIL and the best security practices and so on. They don't accept a virtual firewall. They accept only a physical appliance that has physical inside, physical outside. I mean, that's the whole problem because we can't put the firewall in the hypervisor because people don't like it.
Marco, there are two totally different things. One is putting firewall in the hypervisor kernel, where it intercepts the traffic going in and out of a virtual NIC that is used by a VM. And the other one is putting a firewall in a VM, which also sits on top of the hypervisor kernel and runs like every other VM. So the firewall in a VM is like a Linux box, if you wish, that's doing the firewall functionality, only it's not a physical box, it's a virtual box sitting on top of a hypervisor. Whether people consider that secure or not is a different story.
Yeah,
those people shouldn't use the same servers for inside and outside segments.
Yeah.
And almost everyone is doing that.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of inside and outside is an artifact of physical firewalls. It's not the real thing about a firewall is it prevents access from here to here, zone one to zone two. The only reason that we, or, you know, trusted to untrusted, the only reason we talk about inside to outside is because firewalls had to have 10 years ago, 15 years ago, one interface could only be in one zone and one interface could only be in another. I mean, I still work in customer sites where they say only this interface here can have untrusted VLANs on it and only this interface can have trusted VLANs, which is utterly ridiculous, right? Because the definition of trusted and untrusted is largely arbitrary, but also because every VLAN internally to the code is completely isolated. So if you're using PVLANs on the untrusted interface, it makes no difference. So.
And by the way, both interfaces are plugged into the same switch, right?
Yeah, well, sometimes, not always, but sometimes.
That depends. That's not always the case. But still, even if you're having, if you have the need to explain this to me, and I consider myself that I know a thing or two about networking, can you imagine how it is explaining the difference between the hypervisor-based firewall and the VM-based firewall that is actually the same as the physical, just not physical, it's virtual, to someone who may not be as technically competent? I mean, this is the root of the problem of what do we do with the firewall in the virtual environment. I mean, just like with everything else, when we go into the virtual world, when we start talking about the virtual networking, the things change fundamentally. Our understanding of what the network is needs to change. It's not only about the security, it's not only about the interconnections, it's about everything.
Yeah, so you have to have a flexible mind to adapt yourself to the purpose of security is to prevent access and to log access. And a virtual firewall works the same. And another question came in which said, virtual firewalls have a security performance hit? And I think Larry might be the best person to understand this, but the answer is broadly no. The virtual firewalls that you put on the hypervisor will run up to multiple gigabits per second and insert very low latency. Certainly for Larry, is that correct for the Nexus 1000V? It's very low latency and very high speed for the VASA and the VSG stuff, isn't it?
Well, I would say that, you know, anytime you take something, it comes down to implementation, right? You could have a physical firewall that's nothing more than some software running on a server, essentially, in its appliance. In which case it would be comparable, or you could have one that has a lot of network processors that is all doing things in parallel and uses PCAMs and that's quick. So when it comes to latency, right, it comes down to the implementations and not necessarily whether it's a virtual machine or a physical appliance that sits outside of a hypervisor. But naturally, inside a hypervisor, it has to be software. You don't have any ASICs running inside your virtual machines. So people start talking about low latency. They're talking in tens of nanoseconds, and they care about things like that. So I don't know if I'd go as far as to say that they're going to be equal going through a virtual machine as they would on a physical appliance.
Yeah, sorry, I was abstracting for the general enterprise use case. So, yeah, if you're a financial institution who's doing New York Stock Exchange fin trading and you're caring about a couple of nanoseconds, then it's going to be slower because it's software, right? But for the general enterprise use case where you just, you know, as long as it's going, it goes fast enough and doesn't introduce too much latency to be noticeable, it's going to be fine. And that's what most virtual firewalls are doing. I don't...
Yeah. And there is a fundamental difference that needs to be explained. So we have a firewall in a VM. It has two interfaces, and it passes the packets from one interface to the other, filtering them on the way. Every single packet that this firewall looks at has to go through the user space on the hypervisor. So there are a number of context switches as the packets move through the firewall. And that's where you get the performance hit. On the other hand, you have the firewalls that are embedded in the hypervisor kernel. And these firewalls could be slow if they're implemented improperly, where they send every packet into a VM and back, or they could be fast if they actually do all the processing in the hypervisor kernel. And Nexus 1000V, well, VSG to be precise, is like the best of both worlds. Because Nexus 1000V would send the first packet of a new flow or the first few packets of a new flow to an external VM, so that's slow. But then that VM could install flow data into Nexus 1000V. And that flow data would then be passed straight, would allow the packets to be passed straight through the kernel. So there would be no VM involvement anymore, and that would be fast. And yet again, sorry to mention that, it's exactly like what OpenFlow is doing, only it has been implemented a few years before OpenFlow, before we knew OpenFlow existed.
I've had enough OpenFlow this week. I don't actually want to keep going. There's just been so much going on.
Okay, I'm fine. I'll stop.
So what I...
While we are mentioning OpenFlow, before we go into another discussion, there is one question there in the Q&A that we haven't really addressed, and that I think it's a very interesting one. It's an ancient old problem. And the question is, what are the MTU considerations that need to be done on a physical network when implementing VXLAN?
Simple, you need jumbo frames.
Yeah.
Yes, but what if your server... Okay, good. Fair enough, taken for granted. But what if your application, for example, relies on jumbo frames and you are using yourself very large frames? How do you embed those large frames into the physical network? So what kind of is there support for fragmentation? How is that handled? No. And so on. So there is, well, that's a simple answer, but someone is going to run into that issue. So how is that going to be handled?
So I can respond to that. So jumbo frames, at least as far as I know, means anything above 1500 is a jumbo frame. And different switches support different sizes of jumbo frames, varying up to 9000 and something. So the overhead that VXLAN adds is 50 bytes. So if you assume that your physical infrastructure can handle, say, 9000 byte jumbo frames, that means that you would be limited to the jumbo size that a virtual machine could see to 8,950-byte jumbo frames. So the difference there when you get up to that size is negligible. You really don't want to go to fragmentation. As soon as you do that, any gain that you got with going to jumbo is going to be negated by having to reassemble the fragments.
Also, Marco, remember that in virtual environment, the virtual NIC is presented to the VM from the hypervisor kernel. And so the hypervisor kernel, who emulates the hardware of the virtual NIC, can impose the maximum MTU on that NIC. Hmm. So you can configure in the hypervisor what the physical MTU on that virtual NIC would be. So the VM cannot send larger frames than what you configure in the hypervisor, because the device driver would say, no, you can't do that.
Which, of course, scales to hundreds of thousands of nodes. But I think that we have addressed the question that was in the panel, and that is that, well, the MTU considerations is just make sure that you don't send larger frames than your physical network can carry. As I said, ancient old question, but I thought it would be interesting for us to answer.
So I vote to bring back FDDI and Token Ring, because both of those supported 64,000 byte frames. Sorry,
if we would all switch to Fibre Channel over Token Ring, it would be much, much better.
That's right. Fibre Channel over Token Ring is the future.
It took us 40 minutes before we started talking about Fibre Channel over Token Ring. This must be a record.
So I want to move...
Everyone's busy watching their Mountain Lion downloads. They're not paying attention.
I want to move on the discussion now to talk a little bit more about Cisco's VMFlex technology, because personally, just this week, I've probably spent... Well, not this week, but in the last fortnight, I've spent about 100 hours reading up on how FEX works, and effectively how FEX works in Cisco's UCS and gets integrated with VMware. And this idea of actually virtualizing the physical NIC, so in the Cisco UCS, let me try and set a picture there. Inside of the UCS chassis, you have the virtual NIC, you have the Palo NIC, which is Cisco's value-added sort of fancy NIC, and you can actually cut that up into multiple virtual Ethernet NICs, and then present those to the operating system above. Now, that can actually present as a NIC through VMware into the guest, so each guest gets its own NIC. And at that point, you have some fairly interesting things, because it's combined with pinning. And you now have some interesting situations where you can do dynamic Ethernet adapters. So you can actually have a single Ethernet adapter which goes through the FEX 2200, through the UCS 6200 Fabric Interconnect, and then actually appears as a virtual Ethernet port on your Nexus 5000. Now, has anybody here done that? David, are you familiar with that technology?
No, cool stuff, but I can't say I've tried it myself. It is amazing what you can do with UCS in terms of the scalability, and it just brings up more of these virtual machine networking issues.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
Well, the thing is that I was delivering a so today I was designing up, running through ideas around. There's a thing in Cisco's FEX strategy called AdaptFX, where you create a virtual NIC in the Palo, and then you present that through VMware into the guest. And then that, using this AdaptFX or AFX, then appears as a port on the Nexus 5000 upstream from the UCS 6200, so from the Fabric Interconnect. And that's fixed. So that logical cable goes all the way from that adapter all the way up to the Nexus 5500 and appears as a virtual Ethernet port. And that means that you can then know exactly where that server connects. So the networking guy goes conf-t in, and there's gets an Ethernet interface, and the server guy sees one NIC. But even though it's one NIC, it's still redundant. So it's actually a hardware failure if it goes on underneath, and it goes via an alternate path up to the Nexus 5500, but still appears as an Ethernet port. And I was pretty surprised to learn about that. Mind you, you have to get an awful lot of knowledge together before you start to understand that, and that takes me a long time to learn hard stuff. But that seems to make a difference to how I would imagine a VMware goes, because it replaces the vSwitch or the VDS thing, but gives you a whole bunch of new options for,
I mean, it's a different approach. I mean, back to the idea of giving people different options, right? And the other thing to point out with VMFest is it also works with KVM as well as VMware.
And Hyper-V.
But, eventually.
Well, it gives a solution for NICs to Hyper-V because it allows you to present a single NIC and then you use hardware.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a hardware-software tension, right? And certainly for a number of folks that, this part of my earlier point, right, a lot of the discussion comes, tends to gravitate towards software switching, but there are we have a whole community of folks that aren't really comfortable with that. They still rather have the networking function happen in the network as opposed to, in this fuzzy no man's land that is sometimes hypervisor-based switching. So it gives you a different approach in terms of, how you get it done.
Since you were talking about the hypervisor switch now, there was one question very early in the panel, and how is the virtual network environment going to change now that VMware has more aggressively went into addressing the networking inside their hypervisor by the recent acquisition?
So one of the things we do with this particular forum is we kind of stay away from vendor discussions in general,
okay,
because there are no other vendors here to advocate their position. So we're trying to keep it, unlike other places, we try and keep it in the weeds and talk about technology and protocols and that kind of stuff. So we'll, and we also happen to be in quiet period from a Cisco perspective, so we'll defer those types of discussions for.
Okay.
I feel confident that packet pushers might discuss it in the near future.
Yes, I imagine that packet pushers might indeed have something to say on that topic, but suffice to say, it's not the end of the world.
No, and there's been plenty of discussion around that. So I think, but that's a good point. I mean, maybe we can take some key messages around that. Is that the FEX concept that I was talking about just there, which is where the idea that the virtual network adapter can actually be instantiated into multiple virtual NICs, which can then be presented to the operating system above, is very powerful in its way. And then you can have a whole bunch and the challenge comes in then is where, as a networking guy, when you sit down with your server teams and you start saying, well, I can give you two NICs and then you can connect to them as LACP, and then you have to think about how those then connect through your FEXs to your FI up to the 5500s. Or you can say to them, I can present you with one NIC, and then they go, oh, but it's not, there's not two, therefore it must be failure prone. And you say, but no, at a hardware level, they just automatically switch over. And and then you can have all different things. You can have layer two switching on the FI, and it's quite complex. And I find myself having to keep coming back to it. So that's hardware. That's still a hardware solution. And there's one thing that I want to say to people, which is there's another standard coming down the pipe called IEEE 802.1BR, which is a successor to one technology we used to talk about called 802.1QBG, which is where we actually start to create things called...
BH.
BH? BG. No, BG is still in the pipe. BH is dead. Yeah, BR replaces BG. Yeah. BH.
BR replaces BH.
Yeah, and BG is still alive and kicking.
Yes.
Sort of.
And supported by a few other vendors that we will not mention today.
Today, yes. So 802.1BR supports the concept of a virtual Ethernet bridge, which is where you can actually create, and where you see the word bridge, substitute the word switch. So it turns the NIC into a switch in hardware, or you could actually have a switch which is in software, just in case you're not confused enough. And then you can also create a thing called a virtual Ethernet port adapter, which is where you actually say the NIC has to loop the traffic back up to some other switching destination.
Oh, no, sorry, Greg, that is EVB.
That's it. I knew that. I couldn't quite get the words out of my head. I'm sitting here looking at questions in the panels.
VR is a total point-to-point architecture like you have with AdapterFX or VMFX today.
Yes.
So EVB allows you to turn the packets around in the hypervisor or through VAPA to send them out and back.
Yes.
And VR creates emulated point-to-point links, like you were describing previously with VMFX or AdapterFX.
Yes, and the value, if I understand this right, because I'm not very bright. I'm mentally challenged most days of the week.
Oh, you are.
So 802.1BR also includes a signaling layer where the VEB and the configuration on the server actually communicates with the switch adjacent to it. So they actually exchange data. So you can actually, the server people, so VMware could come down and say, I need to access these VLANs. And the server would then, the VNIC would then actually request permission to have those VLANs. And if the upstream switch allows it, it would then be able to use them. Or it could actually form a request, and then the networking administrator could say, yes, I will allow that VLAN to be presented to that virtual NIC on that virtual host. And that now that hardware practice, so this 802.1BR standard, as I understand it, and I don't know if Larry or Omar want to jump in here and correct me if I'm wrong, actually replaces all of the features that software switching give us with something that we can deploy into our networks today. That's what I want, because this interoperates with my current network today.
Well, Greg, it depends on where you want to do the switching and whether you believe in soft or hard switching.
I believe in all of it. It's all networking, and it's all part of the family.
VMFX, actually, in its final implementation that came out with vSphere 5, it totally bypasses the hypervisor eventually. So they did a great job, and first it looks like a soft switch, and then it starts looking like point-to-point wires into the physical switch, and eventually you can configure a feature where they actually implement dynamic hypervisor bypass. So a VM is talking straight to the physical hardware. Now, this is great if you believe that all the configuration should be done on Nexus 5000, for example. There are other people who say, no, let's look the other way and let's do all the soft switching on the hypervisors. And with things like VXLAN, the hypervisors can be well integrated with the rest of the network because, well, they only need IP.
So, David, have you heard, I mean, you're the VMware guy here. Is this the sort of stuff that you think could work?
Yeah. You know, I guess. You know, I'm still wondering, you know, what the interest is out there, you know, with the Cisco, you know, Nexus 1000V and VXLAN. I mean, what types of companies out there are actually, you know, implementing this? I mean, are they just service providers, you know, the big vCloud, you know, data center companies? Or, you know, have you guys seen a lot of, you know, mid to large size enterprises actually implementing VXLAN?
Well, from the nature of your question, it sounds like you're saying you haven't seen that. Is that right, David?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, just simply because of the cost. I mean, first you need, you know, vSphere Enterprise Plus, and then, you know, you're buying, the Nexus 1000V per server, you know, so... and then to use VXLAN, you know, is it true you have to use vCloud Director? Or I guess you don't have to.
No, you don't
most
have.
People are.
So I think it depends on who you're asking. So at least the cloud provider, service provider that I've talked to, I think the thing that appeals to them is the scalability, right, the gazillions of VLANs because they're trying to maintain this multi-tenancy environment. You talk to large enterprises, I think that the transport simplicity is – what makes it easier? I mean, I think for them, the pitch is, hey, you know, you have the X-WAN, and I don't have to worry about layer 2 adjacency or tunneling or these kinds of things. It all gets handled in the intelligence of the protocol. So I've certainly seen interest from my perspective, I've certainly seen interest from both, but for different reasons.
Okay. And then how many different competitors are there to VXLAN? Oh, at least two? SCP and what, NVGRE?
And there's the IBM one, which I don't really like.
Okay.
I forget what that is.
So how much?
Actually, that's a good question for Larry I wanted to work out. I mean, Larry's steeped in a lot of this stuff. Do we think there'll be eventual convergence? Do we think this is an environment that'll stay with multiple tunneling protocols? And, you know, that's just the way it's going to be. Or, you know, Larry, do you see any kind of coming together of minds within the standards bodies on this stuff or not?
I don't think I'm seeing a coming together of minds on what the particular encapsulations are.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're focusing on is a coming together on the control plane, which is a much harder problem. So if I look at it, especially from a software point of view, right, changing the, if I compare, say, NVGRE to VXLAN, they contain basically the same things. The bits are just moved around in different places. So we can write some code and move the bits around and support NVGRE. The tricky part is getting it to interoperate, which means you need to have some kind of control plane for setting up the forwarding entries. And that's the hard work that needs to be done in the ITF.
So it sounds at some point it might be the protocol might become less important once you've got some sort of unified control mechanism in place.
Yeah, I don't think that it will make a big difference exactly. What each encapsulation will have its pros and cons, and we'll have people who want one or the other. You know, from my point of view at Cisco's, we should try to support whatever our customers want, right? And if we move the bits around in one way and makes them happier, then, well, okay, great.
Yeah, I think STT isn't a serious consideration because it's only owned by one company, and it doesn't look like it's going to break out of that limited marketplace. And NVGRE seems to have some shortcomings, so it doesn't seem like most networking people are going to take it seriously. So at the moment, VXLAN appears to be the strongest, from my personal opinion, subject to change at any time. Feel free to ring me up and send me an invoice, and I'll give you a second opinion. hey, I've got school fees to pay. Be nice, you know? Come on. okay, so one thing I wanted to say is we've talked a lot today about a lot of design questions and a lot of quite complex issues. It's also possible, we talked a lot about VMware, but a lot of these concepts that we've talked about also apply or will apply with Cisco's product roadmap in the future, which we learned a lot about during our discussions at Cisco Live. Have a look in the priority queue feed if you want to find out more about those. But there's a lot of stuff. I was hoping to find some time today to talk about design best practices and how some of these things could come together, but you know, it just hasn't been possible in the hour that we have set aside here. So what I'm going to encourage you to do is there's a whole bunch of really good presentations from Cisco that talk about how FEX works, how UCS works, how VXLAN works, and how NX1000V go. You should get a hold of your reseller or your Cisco account manager and beat them up until they deliver you about 500 gigabytes of presentations and technical briefings. If not, then I'm sure we can find a way to get some information to you. Leave a comment on the show, and we'll see if we can point you to the right places for some white papers and stuff. Would that be fair, Omar?
Yeah. The other place to check out is Cisco Live 365, and pretty much anything we presented at Cisco Live is posted there, so that's another resource out.
Yeah, I have 300.
We should also point out that the access to it is now free, so there is no paywall to access it, and the presentations that, so for those who can't attend Cisco Live in person, Cisco Live 365 is absolutely the most brilliant resource that they can use to get that kind of information. So fantastic place to go.
I strongly recommend that. So what I want to do is go back around the table and say thanks to everybody for attending today, because we do only have 60 minutes of time. Thanks, David Davis, for joining us today. Tell people where they can find you.
They can find me at transsignal.com or vmwarevideos.com. Thanks for having me. Really interesting discussion.
Thanks. No problems. Mr. Banks?
Hey, thanks for having me on today. And I'll be on the packetpushers.net blogging and, of course, on Twitter at ECBanks.
Mr. Pepponiak?
either at iOS Hints or ioshints.info or ipspace.net. And thanks for inviting me today.
No problems. And also to the audience, if you want to go and hang out, Ivan's got some very good webinars where he's collected some great training material together. And he does cover some of these topics, if not all of them, in good structured detail. I can recommend those to you for a very nominal fee, of course. Larry, tell us a little where people can find you, or not, as the case may be. I'm not sure if you're publicly available or not.
I have no blog, and I don't have a Twitter either. So
Larry doesn't actually
send me an email.
He doesn't actually exist.
I do have email.
Postcard.
Yeah.
He can tell Larry does actual work, unlike the rest of us.
Yeah, that's pretty much true. Marko Milivojevic, tell the audience where they can find you.
You can be found on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at icemarcom, and I am blogging relatively regularly at blog.ipexpert.com.
Thanks for joining us, Omar.
You can find me on Twitter, Omar Sultan is my handle, and blogs.cisco.com/datacenter.
And Mr. Foskett.
This is Stephen Foskett. You can find me on Twitter at sfoskett. You can find my blog at blog.foskett.net. And if you go to truthinit.com, you can see some seminars that I'm touring the country talking about topics like this as well. And I will second Fred's recommendation of Ivan's webinars as a great resource. And I will third Marco's recommendation of the Cisco content as another great resource for information like this. And I will also raise you one by suggesting, if you're going to be at VMworld, I think that there will be quite a bit of information of this sort presented, though, of course, no one's sure exactly what's going to be presented yet.
No, and VMware doesn't make it freely available. Boo, VMware. And, of course, I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com and also on the Twitter as at etherealmind. As always, leave your feedback on the show. This has been a Cisco Virtual Symposium. It's been sponsored by Cisco to talk about virtual machine networking. It was recorded on the 25th of July. Thanks to the audience for joining us today. It's been great to have almost 50 people joined us at the peak, which is pretty astonishing that you people want to sit around and listen to us talk nerdy. As always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.